Succession number 19041, Reel 4.
George Franklin, Reel 4.
The patrol of 10, peculiar as it may seem, 7 were the ones, 7 injured, or 2 killed and the rest injured. But the three who escaped any injury at all was the three leading ones who led into the minefield. It was the ones behind who got caught. But that because they'd had so many stretchered, 2 killed and 3 wounded, which was needed stretchers. There must have been about 20 or 30 of us went down to this minefield with stretchers to pick them up and bring them back. Couldn't leave them there. And we was bringing them back. And we thought we was walking in minefields again, but in actual fact, we was going around the front of our position and our own guys were throwing grenades at us. Because they didn't know we were there. They'd heard the mines going off, but we thought they were mortars anyway. We didn't realise they were mines until they radioed back and said that the patrol had walked into a minefield. And they just said, right, come on lads, you better go and get your pals. So we all jumped over the parapet. There must have been about 20 or 30 of us from different parts of the company and went down to pick them up. And oh, probably less than that, but we went down to pick them up, and it's a struggle to bring them up through the barbed wire fence because the barbed wire fence is not the entrance to a barbed wire fence is not in a straight line; it's in a zigzag, so you had to manoeuvre your way around it. And what struck me most of all is that walking along a crawl trench with this crawl trench sounds like a crawl trench, but in actual fact, it's around about 3 feet high. And to get a stretcher down this crawl trench, which is not very wide, your knuckles are scraping the side of the trench. And I stopped the bloke in front of me for a minute, and I said, hang on, his arm's rubbing against the trench, but not realising, I knew he was dead, but I still thought he was being hurt by his arm dragging along the side of the trench. I don't think I'd better describe how bad he was, but the mines had done damage, real damage. One of my other mates I went in the army with, who I went into Shawncliffe with and went through all the army up until he got wounded, he got injured in the left shoulder and the left leg, the calf of his left leg, and they shipped him out to Sasebo in Japan for rehabilitation. Never saw him until we were coming home. Never saw him again. But of course we was then short of people in our platoon, so we had to rob people from 5 and 6 platoon to make up the for our stag duties of the night. But of course it must have been about a week later after our platoon of that patrol had got caught into the minefield, we saw they were digging. The Chinese were digging trenches halfway up their hill. You could see the diggings through the binoculars from the OP post. You can see there were new diggings, and we had orders to go out there and blow this bunker up. You could see it was a bunk, it was an enormous thing. So this particular night, we went out didn't go out till 3 o'clock in the morning, and there was 15 of us went out. We was all armed with machine guns and Bren guns and Sten guns. No one had a rifle, but we had to borrow the Sten guns. We had to borrow the Bren guns. We never had enough to go out with, to borrow them from different companies, different platoons. And anyway, we went out there, and two assault pioneers were with us, and they had an explosive on the end of a stick. I don't know too much about explosives, but that's what they had anyway. And these two assault pioneers came out of us, who were, they'd learned explosives in their training, but they were an actual attached to HQ company, but they came up to our company to go out with us that particular night, or early morning. And we went across the valley to a stream, which was frozen, and the sergeant in charge of us, it was a sergeant in charge of us, he said, I'll go across first, and then I'll call you over. And he went across first, and luckily enough, the stream was only about 2 feet deep, and he fell in it. And of course, it eased the tension, actually, because we all started giggling, but I think it was nerves which was making us giggle. When we got to the other side, and on the other side of the stream, which was, I suppose, about 15 feet wide, and we waded through that, we got across on the ice, and some of us got feet wet as well on the edges. But we got to there, here, got to that stream, and then there was the MSR, which was the main supply route, which was really only a track. There was no tarmac roads or nothing like that. And we got up onto their hill, and we got up to this bunker, and we we done an all-round protective screen while the a couple of our blokes threw in a couple of grenades and a phosphorus grenade into the bunker. And then the salt pioneers put the explosive in and set it, and up it went. And there was rocks and things flying about all over the place. It was landing all around us. A friend of mine, he got hit on top of the head, but he was all right. It was just a glancing blow, I should think. Anyway, we get down to the bottom of the hill, and these machine guns opened up. We got across the stream, and they were still firing, and they were buzzing all over our heads. But we realised that they weren't actually firing at us. They were firing at the position we'd come out of, on our side of the hill. They knew where we'd come from. They must have done, because you could see they were using tracer. And you could see the tracer going over our heads, a good way above our heads, but landing where we had come out of our position previously. Well, we lay down there for about 15 minutes, I suppose, and then the machine gun stopped. And our sergeant said, right, line up the... So we lined up the Bren guns. We had about four Bren guns. And he said, right, now reply. So, of course, we all started to... Although I had a Sten gun, never a Bren gun at the time. We all started to hammer away with these Bren guns up to where we could see the machine guns are coming from. And I suppose they must have used a couple of magazines, which holds about 32 rounds, I suppose. Must have used a couple of magazines. And then the machine guns opened up again, but they weren't with tracer this time. They were with bullets. Although tracer, when you see tracer, it looks as if they're very slow, but in between each tracer bullet, there's four live ones as well. So it's a stream of bullets, but every other five is a tracer. And they're burning ones. But anyway, these machine guns opened up on us. And then the mortars started opening up on us. And then the tracer started opening up onto that position where we'd came out of. And we knew we couldn't get back in our position, because it was being heavily... it was being heavily fired at. So the sergeant said, right, oh lads, we'll go back through 6th Platoon. So whereas when we were looking back on our position, which I explained in previously, was like the head of a hammer, looking back on our position as if he was looking out the head of a hammer, B Company was to the left, 4th Platoon was to the left, and 6th Company was to the right. 6th Platoon was to the right. So we went back up into 6th Company, went back up through their position, to get back on our company or platoon position before dawn, because dawn is when you stand to when attack would possibly come in. I suppose it was about, and that was that episode, and I suppose it was about another week later, we was just coming back off patrol, coming back through our position. It had been quiet. It's like when you're waiting for a thunderstorm. You can feel it coming, but you don't know when it's going to happen. And it had been very, very quiet. There had been no shelling, no mortars, no machine guns. And we're just coming back off patrol. Must have been about 9 o'clock at night off a listening patrol, because bearing in mind, it used to get dark around about 5, 6 o'clock. So a listening patrol used to go out and then used to come back around about 9 or 10. And then, or because they then got relieved by another, anyway, they'd got relieved and was coming back, and these shells came over, and that was heavy stuff. It was real, real heavy stuff. It wasn't the small 88mm shells. This was big stuff. And it was knocking hell out of our positions. Absolutely knocking hell out of them. And there's nothing you can do. You just hide in your bunker. And then as the shells were, as the shells were coming down, we in between the shells, you might as well say, we had to get out in the trench, because we knew that it sounded like an attack was coming in, because the sergeant and the lieutenant had come round and said, "Keep your eyes open, lads. It looks like we're in for a packet tonight." And then we heard these bugles and the whistles, and we knew this was it. We was being attacked, and they must have used our position as a... We must have been on a position where they used... It was a feint. It was a... how do you put it? What a feint would be. Because the main attack was going in onto another hill to our left. The left of 6th Platoon, I should say, was going on the A Company of KOSBs. The main attack went in there. The feint attack went into us first. And we was just firing down through the wire, and the machine guns were firing, and mortars were firing, and it was mayhem. And there was fairy lights going up. It was like, and they were coming down the hill like ants. And it was absolutely, it was like daylight. The fairy lights, they really do shine up of a night. And on top of that, they used to shine way, way, way back. They used to shine searchlights up into the sky, and they used to reflect off the clouds and give you artificial moonlight. And but as I say, the feint was coming in on us, on B Company, but the actual main attack went in onto KOSBs, and they got pushed off. A Company got pushed off. And they countered off, I don't know whether it was D Company or whatever, one of their companies that counterattacked, and went back up onto A Company of KOSB's position, because our 6th Platoon was given them covering fire while they were being attacked and counterattacking as well. And 6th Platoon, I've got to think of my memory. I believe it was D County, KOSBs, went back onto their position with a counter-attack. And when they got there, there was no one there. All the people which had been, all the Chinese which had been killed, were gone. They'd taken them all back, taken them back to their own positions. Now, it's only in recent years that I found that it was possible that the reason why they disappeared so quick is that it's possible that they weren't coming down the hills, although we saw them coming down the hill. KOSBs, where their position was, they were only a couple of hundred yards away. It's possible that they were coming out of a tunnel. They probably might have dug a tunnel through the hillside, because it has been proved over the years that they found a tunnel in Korea which went 10 miles back, where you could get a battalion could march through there, and no one would ever know. They'd marched 10 miles. So that was possible an explanation why they had disappeared so quick. There was no dead bodies there, they'd all gone. Could I just stop a minute?
What roughly is the date of this?
The date is March 1952. The exact date I don't know, but it was March 1952 because it was then after that position we moved back to rest area, the same area was in rest before with the Kiwi gunners, peculiar as it may seem. And lo and behold, we got back onto this position, which was now April, and we was there about 3 weeks, and it was just the 3 weeks then became around about the 1st of May 1952. And in those 3 weeks, the battalion had organised football games between each battalion, because it was 5 miles back, we could afford to relax, and relax in general, volleyball, football, just to keep us occupied. But at the same time, we also went back to the Kansas line, what they call the Kansas line, which was way back across the Indian River, where the Gloucestershire Regiment had been overrun, and to reinforce the position on the Kansas line. I think each battalion took its turn in reinforcing this position as time was going on. But when we, after about 3 weeks, around about the first, probably the 2nd of May, I'd been out there then now by November, we'll say December, January, February, March, April, just over 5 months, and I was now due for a leave. And it my turn came up, me and this guy of mine, this friend of mine, for 5 days leave in Japan. We just grabbed our kit, got on the company truck, went down to our echelon. Then from our echelon, we got into all the fellas from each company, all got onto the same truck, I suppose about 20 of us got onto the same truck, and went to Kimpo Airport in Seoul, got on a plane, I think it was a I can't remember the name of the plane. It was American four-engine prop aircraft. And they took us to an airport in Tokyo. I can't remember the name of the airport. It was a military airport anyway. And then we was taken to Ibushu camp. Well, after 5.5 months of ice and snow, living on the floor, eating out of tins, but I must admit, we had sea rations all the time. It was out there. American sea rations we used to eat all the time, which was quite good, actually. Very good. I wouldn't say quite good. They were very, very good. We never starved. We always had plenty of food. But it was when we got to Ibushu camp, it was luxury because we had a bed to lie in with clean white sheets. We had a bath, got deloused. Our uniforms were taken away. When we got to Ibushu camp, we had all our combat uniforms on, which were torn from barbed wire, going through barbed wire. Filthy dirty. The only things we used to keep clean was our boots and our ammunition, and not ammunition, our rifles and so forth, which we have to keep clean for our own safety's sake. Because when we got to Ibushu camp, they took all this away from us to give us a khaki uniform to wear, and it was luxurious. Absolutely, it was like a little kid lying in bed for hours on end, just to lie there, just to be. Well, it was absolutely wonderful. And then, because we used to go out, we used to get a taxi into Tokyo itself, and go into the Ginza, which was like Oxford Street, I suppose. I suppose it still is. Ginza's still there. But I think it was the main area of Tokyo was the Ginza. And we went to a nightclub, because he was only there 5 days. And after those 5 days, we had to give the khaki uniform back and picked up our combat uniform, which had been cleaned and pressed by the Japanese, and put that back on, and picked up our rifles, got onto a truck, and then back to the battalion. Well, when we got to the battalion, which was now about the 10th of May, we was told that we was going to, the rumour went round, I should say, that we was going to do a seaborne landing. It was only a rumour, but it seemed to gain momentum. And because there was people who with more know-how, if you like, or more suspicious and speculating than anything, they said, but they were saying, how can we do a seaborne landing? We've never been trained to do a seaborne landing. We're not Marines. We're not American Marines or Marine Commandos or parachute regiments, you know. We're just ordinary infantrymen. But it worked out. We were going to go up to Kojido, to the prison camp. We didn't know where Kojido was, but it was right at the end of the Korean Peninsula. And evidently they'd been having riots down there with the communist prisoners and the non-communist prisoners, which were mixed in the same compound, and they were fighting one another. We were taken down on a train, the whole company, only B Company was going. A B Company of King's Tropical Light Infantry and a company of the Royal Canadian Regiment. We all got on the same train, and I suppose it took about 2 or 3 days because it was a single track railway, a steam engine, all the way down to Pusan. And then they put us on all our kit, was taken on truck. We got onto an LS, what's it called? LST, landing.
That's the landing ship tank.
LCT, landing craft tank, LCT, which had open doors. The doors opened like the ferries do going across to France now. It's only a small thing, but we've got on that. And it took us over to Kojido Island. Now, this I'm not too sure of, but I'm 95% sure that we more or less lined up on the beach. No, it wasn't on the beach. We lined up on a road or on a track. And I'm sure it was Lord Alexander, the General Supremo, came along and gave us a talking to. I'm sure it was General Alexander, Lord General Alexander. I'm pretty sure it was. Anyway, we got to they took us to this compound, Compound 66, where these comms and non-comms had been fighting. They'd captured an American general in this compound. Anyway, they got him out. The Yanks had got him out. And the guy in charge of the prisoners of war was a general called General Boatner. He's only a little man. He's only about 5'2", I should think. But he used to walk. He used to come round. He'd come round and spoke to us as a company. A little pearl handled revolver up on his breast pocket. There it was, and grenades stuck in his belt. And all round the compound was watchtowers with tanks on the hillside. And in between the watchtowers, there was machine gun trenches dug in all the way around. And then it was, these prisoners have got to be separated, the comms from the non-comms. But before we could do that, we've got to get in the compound because they barricaded the gates. We couldn't get in. And of course, you couldn't fire on them because it was you were firing on prisoners, so it wasn't feasible to do it. But eventually what happened was, is this one particular morning, or around about midday, I should say, we were told that they were going to go in today, was going to go in, and the Yanks spearheaded it with stun grenades. They threw stun grenades and broke open the gates, and we just swarmed in like, just like an infantry attack. We just went in there with rifles, and the Yanks had machine guns firing above their heads mainly. And machine guns were firing above their heads as well. And when we broke in, when we got into their area, their recreation recreation hall, you might as well say, in the middle of the compound, because this compound was quite a big compound, had a recreation hall. They'd been making out of tins of their what they had food in, the tins, tin cans. They'd made spears and knives and swords and all that kind of thing, you know, to resist anyone coming in. But because the stun grenades killed all that, didn't kill anyone, but it just stuns them. That's what the stun grenades were for. And so it went off really peaceful, I should say. And then they put them, they separated all these, I suppose they vetted them from comms and non-comms, and put them in smaller compounds of around about 500 each into different compounds. And then what we had to do then was to virtually be a wire guard, just walk around the perimeter of a night and through the day, or do different stags of a night and through the daytime, just guards. And I think we was down there around about 4 or 5 weeks. Through the day, they used to have to come out with these honey buckets, what we used to call honey buckets. They were 50-gallon drums which had been cut in half, and that's where they used to do their toilet. And they used to have to bring them out on a yoke, with these cans either side. They used to have to take them down to the river or the sea part of the island where the compound was, or an area. And just walk along the road and guard them like you would walk along a road, just guarding the prisoners while they emptied these buckets. This was the main thing we did. Because we broke up all there in the compound, we broke everything up and flattened the whole area, so it would be bulldozed flat, and they rebuilt tents and all that kind of thing on there to rehouse the separated prisoners. They'd made new compounds for them to go into in the meantime while we was destroying this one there where they'd been fighting. But there was one episode was that before they'd separated them, the Yanks or the intelligence, or they got some information that they'd killed a couple of their prisoners, a couple of their own men, and stuffed them in a tunnel because they brought a digger up, one of these mechanical diggers, and they were digging on the outside of the fences to try and find the tunnel where the bodies were. And we were told, I didn't see them, but we were told that they found two bodies in a couple of sacks in the trench, which they'd discovered with this mechanical digger. And this, I think this is what prompted them to go in with stun grenades to separate them. Anyway, we was down here about 4 weeks, I suppose, four, maybe 5 weeks, and then we went back to the battalion. We got shipped back up to the battalion, went back up into the front line again.
Did you speak to any of the POWs?
The only time I spoke to the POWs was